Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom in an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. I'm your host, Care Hallenbeck. Thomas Shirgi, S.J., is Associate Professor of Theology at Fordham University, focusing on areas including sacramental theology, liturgical theology, and ritual studies. Previously, he served as Professor of Liturgical Theology at the Jesuit School of Theology at Berkeley. He is a member of the Society of Jesus, or Jesuits, founded by St. Ignatius Loyola 450 years ago. Currently, his interests have turned toward practical theology, that is, an understanding of theology through both practice and theory. He is co-author of the book Living Beauty, The Art of Worship, and his journal articles include This Blessed Mess, An Embodied Worship, A Return to Noble Simplicity, and Go in Peace, Then What? Father Thomas, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Care. It's good to be with you.
Now, the letters SJ that follow your name stand for Society of Jesus, and we'll get to the society and the wonderful story of its founder, St. Ignatius. But first, let me ask a little about your own journey. What led you to your work and ministry?
Well, I like to begin as a boy growing up Italian in Brooklyn. That I think for every boy in that situation, you think about priesthood. It's one of your viable options, you know, along with doctor, lawyer, fireman, Indian chief, and all. A lot of that had to do with the priest was well respected in the community. These were intelligent people, very learned men. They were leaders in the community, and they had a good sense of humor. And being in Catholic school, we were around them. So, like I said, it was a viable option for me. And then later on in college, this idea came back to me when I thought of what I wanted to pursue later on, my interests, say, in philosophy and in law. And I saw the priesthood as a way to incorporate these interests, you know. And then more specifically, I became very interested in the study of theology with very simply the story of Christianity. I was impressed with the story of Jesus, with the adventures of the apostles and the prophets, all these saints and sinners.
Yeah.
I liked the story. And so, in a nutshell, I think this is why I am here today.
Thank you so much. That's a different kind of response we hear very often of, you know, people who are turned off, basically, by the church early on in life for various reasons. And it's interesting to note that you felt very at home and found inspiration in that practically it seems like a cultural presence of the church in your area of Brooklyn.
Oh, very much so, sure.
And so then how did you first hear specifically then of the Jesuits or Ignatius?
Well, for the Jesuits, it goes back to grammar school when we were studying American history. And we learned of the Jesuit missionaries, you know, coming to New York and to Canada. These were heroic men. They were brave, and they were martyred for the practice of their faith. So this was the first time I heard of Jesuits. Later on in high school, although I was in public school then out on Long Island, some of my teachers had gone to Jesuit schools, and they spoke favorably of their experience, you know. And then while I was in college, I did go to a Jesuit college. Also, given my interest in philosophy, I was reading Teilhard de Chardin, a paleontologist and a Jesuit priest, you know, or John Courtney Murray, a theologian who was doing a lot of work on church and state. In fact, they say that he laid the foundation for John F. Kennedy's run for the presidency, the first Catholic. president in the U.S., you know. There was also the poet and activist Father Daniel Berrigan.
Yeah.
So among others, here were, you know, Jesuit priests who were very learned men in the arts and philosophy and involved in politics, and priests. I was impressed with this.
Yes, thank you. And it's very interesting to me as well how the Jesuits are in all fields, and there are some Jesuit astronomers out there at Kitt Peak Observatory in Arizona.
Yes.
But you mentioned early on, yes, in the, I believe it was John Adams, the second president, who had a quote, a kind of a famous quote about the Jesuits being so problematic to him. That these Jesuits have come here and they're everywhere, and they're writers and they're teachers and they're publishers, and they've been called like the most loved and the most hated of all people.
Yes.
Can you share a little bit about that and why he might have said that early on in American history?
Well, because of the reputation that the Jesuits had in Europe, one of the first works that the Jesuits were involved in was education, you know, and founding schools.
Right.
And naturally, the schools at that time, you know, talking about the 17th century, these would be schools for the sons of the elite, you know, of royalty and all this. And the idea was that the Jesuits hoped to have an influence on society through education. And some saw this as devious. You know, as Catherine the Great said, once we educate the masses, we may lose our positions.
Right.
So by educating people here, we had hoped to free people up, develop their critical thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And some government leaders are threatened by this, by, you know, by the simple questioning of authority. And so that's why the Jesuits have been suspect by some.
Well, Father, I think that continues to this day. When we hear so much about the dumbing down of America in recent decades, you know, it makes you wonder. We were kind of sharp in the 60s and 70s and questioning a lot. Lately, it seems people are quite overwhelmed, I think, just with the basic living of life.
Yes, and again, it comes back to this notion of critical thinking. And you know, to be clear, Care, talking about critical here, we don't mean that in a negative sense,
right.
You know, to talk down about something, but rather in the literal sense, from the Greek kritikos, you know, to discern carefully or to analyze.
Yeah.
So do we know what's at heart at these issues here? And to your point, you know, to get away from this blue state, red state mentality, this, if you will, a ghetto type thinking that I think with my group only, but rather to really criticize this, you know, to question it, to know why I stand where I do. And Jesuit education has promoted this from the beginning.
Thank you. Now let's come down to the Ignatius and his remarkable story and legacy. At every movement, there tends to be a central figure that helps
sure.
to ignite it. And for me personally, a doorway into spirituality was Francis of Assisi, who was also an inspiration to some degree to Ignatius as well.
That's right.
And today in the church, we remember Claire of Assisi, and I'll get to her towards the end of the program with a little reflection. But could you please share some of the story of the life of Ignatius of Loyola and his conversion?
Well, I'd be happy to. Ignatius was born in the year 1491 in the Loyola, or the Basque province of Spain. He was the son of the Lord of Loyola, so he grew up with some affluence there, you know, and he was the last of 11 children. Now, just maybe to set the scene when he came into the world, again, 1491, so this is the age of exploration, right? The very next year, Christopher Columbus would be setting sail and discover the Americas. It was also the age of chivalry. So there were many stories of knights, you know, and the life in the court and all this. A little while later, Miguel de Cervantes wrote his great novel, you know, Don Quixote.
Yeah.
It was also the age of mysticism. So contemporaries of Ignatius were Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross.
Right.
And then sometime later, in 1517, you have the Reformation. Okay, so this is all a backdrop for the life of Ignatius of Loyola. But getting to the man himself, so, of those four points I mentioned, Ignatius seemed to be most interested in chivalry. Right, he grew up in the court, and he imagined himself later on in life as a knight, you know, serving the king, defending his country, and rescuing the damsels in distress. So he imagined his life this way. And he writes about himself that he was a very vain young man, you know. He liked to dress up in the breastplate and armor of the knight with those tight leggings, the sword dangling by his side, his long flowing red hair. He cut quite a figure, you know.
Yeah.
And he was quite the ladies' man, too, they say. So this was his life, you know. Well, by the age of 30, he's able to get into battle for the first time. I say able to because he had been looking forward to this.
Mm.
And it's up in the town of Pamplona. Now, we all know Pamplona from the running of the bulls, right?
Right.
Well, this is a little Spanish town, and the French were invading it. So the Spanish troops were at the fort trying to defend their city. And the Spanish general realized that his troops were clearly outnumbered by the French, and he wanted to surrender. Well, Ignatius, who had been itching for battle, would not hear of it. So he rallies the troops, and they rise to the occasion. They want to fight the French, and the general gives the go-ahead. So they lock horns with the French, but no sooner did they begin when Ignatius gets shot in the leg with a cannonball. He goes down. End of the battle. Now, by the way, if you're in Pamplona today, on one of the main streets, you'll see a plaque right in the street that says, on this spot, Ignatius of Loyola fell in battle. So they commemorate that very spot.
Wow, that's an important cannonball.
That's right. That's right. So now the French were kind, you know, they treated Ignatius well, tried to patch him up as best they could, and then his men carried him on a stretcher back home to Loyola. But over hill and down there, the leg did not set well. So he gets home, the doctors come in, and they had to reset the leg, which meant break the bone.
Right.
Right. And reset it, and he recuperates. Now, as he's recuperating, he notices that one leg is shorter than the other, and that there's a bone spur protruding just above the knee. And he's, again, a vain man.
His vanity is still there, yeah.
Yes, very much so. So, you know, how is this going to look in those tight leggings of his and all that? He's more repulsed by that. So he orders another operation, which means to break the leg again. And this, of course, is without anesthesia. All right, so he goes through all this, and he lies in bed for months recuperating. Now, during this time, and this is an important part of his life, he asks for something to read to while away the time, and his sister gives him two books, A Life of Christ and The Lives of the Saints. As he reads The Lives of the Saints, he's really taken with people like you mentioned, Francis of Assisi, you know, or
who had a similar experience of war and wanting that glory as a young man.
That's right, and also coming from an affluent family.
Right.
Right. And then with Dominic, too, who founded the Dominicans. So he reads their lives, and he's impressed with their vision of following Jesus Christ, who is like a king. Right, and of their simple living, their poverty, but it's not debilitating. It frees them, this poverty, to follow their vision. Okay? Meanwhile, he still has fantasies about knighthood, serving the king, defending the country, rescuing the damsels in distress. But here's a crucial development. When he thinks about becoming a knight and all those fantasies, it makes him happy for a while. Then the feeling passes, and he feels sad and empty.
Mm.
But when he thinks about living like a saint, like Francis or Dominic, say, with that intense vision, with that simple living, etc., this makes him happy. But that feeling lasts. It lingers with him. And then he starts to realize that God is calling him, not only through his mind, but also through his affections, you know, through his emotions. And that he believes God is calling him to lasting happiness. So, to make a long story short, he decides to follow the lives of the saints rather than that of a soldier. Now, this is what develops here is what we call the discernment of spirits, discerning how the Spirit of God is speaking to us. And notice, too, what we have here is a choice between two goods. We're not talking about good and bad here.
Right.
Right? Soldier or saint, both are good. The question is, what is God calling him to do? What will make him happy?
And also, I think the question of if you're seeking the material for the sake of worldly glory, you might come up empty. If that's the goal, you can still be a knight serving, as you said, you know, Christ the King instead,
right.
And that might have a different goal that's more fulfilling,
right?
Than just the worldly vanity, as you were saying earlier.
Right. And in fact, Ignatius said something just like this to Francis Xavier, one of his first followers, who was destined to be at the time a businessman, and he came from a family of business people. But he said to Francis, what good would it do to gain the whole world and lose your soul?
Yeah.
You know, and I think we could say in today's parlance, you know, what will make you truly happy? We're talking about lasting happiness.
Right, and true wealth.
Which
may not be measured, you know, at the bank account or how much you can rake in on Wall Street or anything else.
That's right.
That can leave you empty.
Mm-hmm.
So he has this conversion of heart and then returns to life with a different mission.
Right.
And so now how did the Jesuits come into being and how did they become education focused?
Okay. First, how do they come into being? With that discernment of spirits we just mentioned, Ignatius sets down to write about his experience. Okay, and this comes out in the book that comes to be called The Spiritual Exercises. Right, how we listen, how we become aware of God's presence in our life, and how God may be directing us. And he presents these exercises to other people, including his roommates in college. Just a background note, he believes he's now called to the priesthood, but he needs more education. He was lacking in education there. So he eventually finds himself at the University of Paris, one of the great universities of its day, still is. And his roommates are Francis Xavier and Peter Faber. So he begins talking to them about his experience, the discernment of spirits and the spiritual exercises. There are other students around there, too, and they eventually become interested in what he's doing and want to learn more. Now, remember we said before that this is at the time of following the Reformation, and so the church is in a great upheaval.
Right.
So these men, they're following Ignatius. A long story short, they decide to form a religious community, which later becomes a religious order, the Jesuits. And they decide to place themselves at the disposal of the Pope. They will go to him, you know, and wherever he needs these men, they will go. Right. Something, too, that the Catholic Church was in desperate need of then was educated priests. Before the Reformation and then the later the Council of Trent, you didn't have seminaries in the Catholic Church, and many priests were just uneducated, good men, but not educated. And so the early Jesuits took it upon themselves then to found themselves with a good education. Why? So that they could preach to people and open up the Word of God to them in their situation and their day and age, right? And also to listen to them in confession. Mm-hmm. So for them, education was very important. And so as we said earlier, one of the first works they took on was the founding of schools, so that they would be able to educate others and then have an influence in society this way.
Mm, that's fascinating. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
They've become so associated with education around the world and in science and, as I said earlier, astronomy and all the fields of art, very much in the world. And I think in terms of Ignatian values, I believe that world-affirming component is part of that. Could you please share some information about the Ignatian values that he set forth?
Yes, well, I like your phrase, world-affirming, right?
Yeah.
Because the first principle for Ignatius is to be able to find God in all things. Right? So we're not trying to escape from the world here, but rather we believe that we can become aware of God's presence in the world. If for no other reason than God created the world. this is God's work here. I like to think of the world as a museum of the divine.
Mm.
So just as, you know, when we're in a museum gazing on the work of the masters there, we don't know the masters themselves, but we can admire their genius through their work. We get a glimpse of them through the work. So too, for Ignatius, to find God in all things, that we can become aware of God's great goodness through the world around us. But this needs to be cultivated. It doesn't come natural. Do we know how to look and how to listen for it?
Hmm.
And part of the work of the spiritual exercises is just that, to open us, to dispose us to receiving the presence of God all around us.
And so finding God in all things would be one core value. Could you share some more?
Yes. Another one is the principle of indifference. Now, by this we don't mean apathy, you know,
right,
where we just don't give a darn about something. No, indifference says that indifference is about freedom. In a word, it's about freedom. It's freeing us up to find God in all things, and also to find the goal that God has for us. So Ignatius would say concretely, you know, we will use everything available to us so long as it brings us to our goal to be in union with God. Right? So whatever is good for our goal, we can use. And we will avoid anything that distracts us from attaining our goal, that is union with God. So it's this indifference. And I say it is a matter of freedom. You know,
it sounds a bit like detachment in a way.
It is.
Kind of letting God be God and not holding on to any particular idea that you might, you know, want to be boxed into.
That's right. It is a spiritual detachment, sure. You know, and thinking too, we're just finishing up with the Olympics here, you know, and watching the Olympics, I wonder, in terms of our conversation, I think you see a good example of indifference there. You know, you have to admire the discipline of these athletes, you know, and all that they sacrifice for their goal to compete in the Olympics. And they are some of the happiest people I can see, I can hear, as we listen to them interviewed afterwards, you know.
Yeah.
They are very free, and the freedom comes from the ability to follow their goal. They have had to sacrifice much in order to attain their goal, but they have been happy in doing that. So the principle of indifference is, you know, to focus on what will make us really happy. What is God calling us to? Where do we want to be?
Yes.
What will help me to get there? And what distracts me from getting there?
Yes, yes. And there was the remarkable story this week, I'll just share briefly, from the Olympics that the U.S. team that usually takes has been taking gold for like 14 consecutive Olympics, and in a particular race took silver this year, and they were happy to when they realized what had happened when one of the runners in the relay actually broke his leg while running and kept going on the broken leg. They lost a few seconds and didn't know why. Nobody did till afterwards. But they were thrilled to take silver in the under the circumstances that were so filled with bravery and that honor, an honest, you know, effort. That's just, you know, so many beautiful stories that come out.
Oh, that is amazing, right?
Yeah. So now, I really enjoyed the aspect that Ignatius wrote down the spiritual exercises, because in some ways that's something that makes him very unique, is that he had this experience and then wrote down a kind of a pathway or guideposts for us to leave as a legacy to build on.
That's right.
Which is very important. But also, the role of reflection is very key in Ignatian spirituality. Would you share some about the role of reflection in our day and in our work and in these goals that you're referring to?
Right. Well, reflection, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is the great line from Socrates, right? The unreflected life is not worth living.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and especially here on a university campus where I am, you know, we're very much about that. Call to reflect upon our own lives and to reflect upon the life of our society. And it's that critical thinking we mentioned before, to analyze it with particular tools. tools and all. And some of those tools would be, you know, to think about that first principle. So we reflect on our lives trying to find God in all things. We reflect on our lives with this principle of indifference. You know, I think another principle here would be the question, what does it mean to be human? To reflect on that. I dare say many people go through their lives without really addressing that question. What does it mean to be human? We'll never get a concrete answer for it fully, but to grow an understanding of that. Mm. So we need to reflect on our lives this way with critical thinking. Now, there's another part, too. Ignatius said that the Jesuits should be contemplatives in action. Contemplatives in action. So that we need to reflect on our lives, but there comes a time for acting upon that reflection, you know, putting that reflection to good use, and practicing what we believe to be true. And so we need to balance that contemplative in action, in a sense, to share the fruit of our reflection. And then we'll have a balanced life.
Now that's very important because, of course, we can meditate and we can reflect, and very often it can stay there. But for St. Ignatius, it appears that it's important to, from that reflection, to then move forward in this world in that positive way that he refers to, and to perhaps create some action toward justice, perhaps.
Exactly, and this is where the Jesuits were somewhat different from the other religious orders of the day. Now, the Franciscans and the Dominicans, who we mentioned earlier, they're older by several centuries, and they were more monastic in origin. You know, but whereas the Jesuits, we were founded to be more men on a mission. You know, being sent out regularly. So yes, we do pray together, we worship together. You know, we live together in communities, but also that the Jesuits were meant to be on the road, so the contemplatives in action. Hmm. So there was a fundamental difference there for the early Jesuits.
Mm, yes, and of course social justice being a part of this, an important part of this, which we will get to shortly. We're about halfway through the program, Father Thomas. We're going to take a short break. Stay on the line.
Okay.
You are listening to the Godspeed Institute live on the Progressive Radio Network. When we return from our break, we'll continue our conversation on the legacy of St. Ignatius Loyola with Thomas Shirgi, S.J. of Fordham University. Let's spend a couple of minutes now with an old favorite. Stay with us.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back to thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Oh, oh, oh. Wake up, all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. The world won't get no better if we just let it be. Na 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 na. Change it now, just you and me.
Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute. You are live with CARE, and we're talking about St. Ignatius Loyola and the Jesuits with Thomas Shirgi, S.J. of Fordham University. And that was some of Wake Up, Everybody by Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. We're kind of talking about that today in this light, about waking up in our lives, about waking up as teachers, as parents, as people living life together. And Father Thomas, I myself came to faith as an adult. I grew up with parents of different faiths who decided to just sort of, you know, let me decide as I get older. And I did. And I was about 30 years old when I went through the RCIA program at St. Ignatius Loyola Parish in Manhattan, there on Park Avenue.
Oh, sure.
There were about 12 of us who went through the program that year, which is the rite of Christian initiation for adults. And we were of all backgrounds, of every kind of, you know, as a big city would pull together. And by the end of that, it was the night of the Easter Vigil.
Mm-hmm.
1,500 people in the church, all candlelit and completely, utterly silent as we all stepped up to the font one by one. I get misty thinking about it.
It's beautiful.
And lowered my head over the font, and Father O'Connell got misty too, and his hand was shaking a little as he, as I was baptized and received all the sacraments that evening, and
yes.
Left and had a different life following. And you know, years later, it's a lot of why I'm talking to you now.
Well, that's a great story.
And so when we talk about, you know, adults in the city or wherever they are, and the spiritual journey, can you share some about the pertinence, the importance of the spiritual journey in today's world?
Well, the spiritual journey has been important, right, throughout history and for all people. I guess the first thing I think of when I'm asked about what about the spiritual journey in today's world is it seems there's so much to block out the spiritual journey, our society is very materialistic, maybe consumer-driven, especially in the United States.
Right.
We have more of a all too rational or scientific understanding, and of course we need the scientific understanding, there's no question about it, but can that answer all of our questions? I think we have to appreciate that we are spiritual beings. So along with being intellectual and emotional and yes, sexual beings, we are spiritual beings too. And that our soul, for this reason, needs to be fed. There are hungers of the soul here.
Yeah.
And so when we talked before about the discernment of spirits, Ignatius had a great insight into the human condition at that time, that we are seeking a spiritual growth.
Mm. Yes, and he encountered it himself in such a powerful way.
That's right.
And transformative way that seems to be enduring over these centuries, regardless of changes in technology or education or whatnot or communication, so that it's almost as though his life in many ways was that pebble in the lake that sent out many ripples.
Right, right. And I've admired him so much, you know, when I started directing people in the spiritual exercises, because I see how their journeys are playing out very much according to his spiritual exercises. That, you know, before modern psychology, Ignatius had this great insight into the human psyche. And as you mentioned before, Kerr, about like the astronomers, you know, I know the Jesuit astronomers here who, well-skilled in their science and then opening up the galaxies, you know, and the universe this way only helps them to glorify God even more, to wonder about this creator, the genius here of the universe. So, it's Ignatius has fueled their own search this way through astronomy into spirituality.
And isn't that so unique, because there are so many conversations in the world that are pitting religion and science, you know, against each other as a kind of either-or, that the Jesuits are in this really special position, I think, to have the opportunity to be men of science, as well as, you know, wonder and awe as people of faith.
Yes, and that's why for the early Jesuits, when they started the schools, the education in the liberal arts was very important. so that by through these different areas of study, we could better find God throughout the universe. You know, with the sciences, in the natural sciences, we look for God in the natural world, you know. So as we're talking, whether it's biology here on the planet or astronomy, with the social sciences, we search for God within the human condition. You know, with philosophy and theology, we set out to ask the fundamental questions for the person. Again, what does it mean to be a human being? And with the arts, for instance, to marvel at the human creative spirit. Here we are finding God in all things.
Mm. And now then, in addition to some of the values that you have touched on already, there are some charisms, as they're called in Ignatian spirituality, and some might know the word charism or charismatic or think of it in terms of gifts of the spirit. Mm-hmm. In that sense. What do they mean specifically where Ignatius was concerned, for example, you know, the care for the person or cura personalis? Could you share some about those charisms that are central to Ignatian life?
Yes, well, certainly the one you mentioned is key, you know, the cura personalis, right? It's the care for the whole person. So, and we try certainly to implement that in a Jesuit school here at Fordham University, for instance, that we're not only about developing the mind, you know, with feeding the mind. That's very important, yes. But also, as we just said, with the soul, that we are spiritual beings, and we're concerned with the whole person. Again, what does it mean to be a human? You know,
and the body, I'm sure, and the health.
Yes,
yeah.
then proper care for the body. We need exercise, diet, sleep. I have to remind my students of that. You know that we're not machines here. You know, and when all is working together, then you have the fully integrated person. Mm. But I think part of the temptation in our culture is we treat ourselves mechanically. As if we can compartmentalize all these aspects of ourselves. If only we could see ourselves as one, as all these aspects of humanity integrated, mind, body, and soul.
Yes, it will just so balanced, and it sounds healing just to hear about it.
Well,
wouldn't you agree that we've become so busy in our culture, it's almost as though we're so task-oriented, we're humans doing more often than humans being?
Yes, and in fact, that's the question we often ask when we meet, so what do you do?
Right.
You know,
and then people respond with, you know, work titles and awards or college degrees.
That's right. And we are defined that way. And as you say, as we become so task-oriented, and, you know, we like to boast about our full calendars, our busy agendas, what have you. And I was really struck by seeing the play off Broadway a little while ago, The Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis. It's a great book, and it's so relevant for our day and age. But one thing that the devil says in the story is, you know, not to get people to do bad things necessarily, but just keep them very busy. Mm. Keep them run ragged, in so many words. Mm. And he says, never let them enjoy anything. You know, everything must be done for what they conceive as their soul-driven purpose here. And that will ruin us. How many times in the Gospels does Jesus call his disciples to get away with him for a while?
Yeah.
To pray, to regroup,
yeah.
You know.
And the famous story of Mary and Martha, you know, just stop what you're doing in the kitchen there.
That's right.
Come sit with me and talk. Yeah.
That's right. In fact, Mary has chosen the better part, you know. So, we need to be aware of that. And taking this time for reflection is not a luxury. It is a necessity. Mm. Why? Because we are spiritual beings.
And that's, you know, to me that just speaks volumes, because we seem to be getting busier and busier. There are some really good aspects, for example, of the new technologies and ways of communicating, which allow us, for example, to have this conversation right now.
Sure.
You know, from two different places and on the Internet. At the same time, though, with all the social media that people feel responsible to and that can take up so much time on a daily basis, what could they be doing instead of checking in all the time online? you know, in terms of reflection, how could someone's life be, you know, benefit from taking, you know, making it a point of taking those moments?
Right. Well, I don't know if I'm the one to ask about this, Kara. I've quit Facebook.
Oh, you did?
some time ago. I found at first it was good to communicate with people from around the world, but then I found I was just spending so much time reading about people's daily agenda that just wasn't that interesting, and people I hardly knew. So I don't find it helpful. I've heard from some of my undergraduate students, they consider it now an addiction, and they will admit to this, you know, constantly turning to it. It does seem to be something of an addiction that we can't pull ourselves away from it. Like you say, I mean, in some ways, it's an invaluable tool. You know, I hear of how mothers keep in touch with their children this way, and that's great.
Right.
But when I'm turning to it so many times during the day, you know, hoping that or maybe somebody is sending me an important missive, this can become something of an addiction. And again, just distracting us from our real purpose. Nothing bad in itself,
right?
But it can be a distraction.
Yes, there's just so much busy work that we need to keep up with every day.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Now, tell us about your current book project, because I think this is a good lead-in. Everything, this is a working title, Everything is Sacred.
Yes, and an introduction to the sacrament of baptism. The book was published in April.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. Right, so when we first communicated, it hadn't come out yet. But it is out now. And, you know, given your story before about your own baptism at St. Ignatius Parish in Manhattan, this is the foundation for it. I found that when I was helping to prepare families for the baptism of their children and, you know, meet with them in their homes and talk about what we do in the sacrament and why we do it, there was a lot of interest there. And yet there are a lot of people who don't understand this, you know, who wanted to know more about it. And I find there are many Catholic folks and Christians in general who want to know more about the traditions of the Church.
Yeah.
And so it's with them in mind that I wrote this book. And, you know, and I call it Everything is Sacred because, like we said before, part of the Jesuit ethos, that we're finding God in all things, that through the sacraments as a whole, they help us to be aware of God's presence here. And I think especially through the sacrament of baptism, God is speaking to us through this individual who is being baptized, and we celebrate that together.
Share a little bit more about that, about baptism, for the folks who may not be as familiar around the world with this particular sacrament.
Oh, sure. Baptism is the age-old introduction to Christianity. If you can picture, say, John the Baptist, and we read about this in the Gospels, he's at the River Jordan and calling people to repent of their sins and turn back to the lives they believe they have been truly called.
Right.
And then Jesus himself is baptized. And his last instruction to his disciples after the resurrection, before he leaves the earth, is for them to go out to teach all the nations and to baptize. And so they took this command quite seriously. And so to this day, we baptize. And what does baptism do? Two things here. It's incorporation and absolution. Incorporation, it's an initiation into the body of the Church. So one becomes a member of the Church through the sacrament of baptism. And the absolution, that one is absolved from one's sins. And we're talking about here original sin. And what is original sin? Very simply, it is the human tendency toward evil. Hmm. To be clear, human beings are good. Why? Because we're made by God. We are essentially good. But have you noticed? We don't always act in the right way.
Right, especially when self-seeking.
Precisely.
Yeah.
We don't always act in the way we should, you know, and sometimes we hurt others. We're aware of that. And so we seek to come back to the right path. So baptism symbolically washes away the effects of that original sin and points us on the right path. And with the help of the Church community, then we can walk in the path that God has called us to. We are also then marked, and St. Augustine talked about this back in the 4th century. We receive an invisible but indelible or permanent mark. So we are marked as a son or daughter of God. And this comes from an old practice with the Roman army. That's where the word sacramentum comes from. Because back in ancient Rome, when a recruit became a soldier in the Roman army, he would undergo this sacramentum. He would pledge his allegiance to the gods of Rome and to his commanding officer. And then he would be branded, sometimes with a real brand, you know, the way a rancher brands a steer or a horse, or it could be a tattoo. But the brand would have the seal of Rome, that SPQR, and then the insignia of his regiment. And so this on his arm would show that he is a member in good standing of the Roman army, entitled to all the rights and privileges of a soldier. And so in the second century, as the Christians are baptizing and they're trying to explain to others what they're doing, they compared it to the sacramentum, so that the new Christian pledges his or her fidelity to Jesus Christ, who is the Son of God, and to the community. And in turn, the community pledges its support to walk with this person, accompanying him or her through the life of a Christian. And then the person is marked, again, with this invisible but indelible brand.
Right, and that doesn't mean that someone is perfect or sinless after that.
No.
But it doesn't.
But that we know the way back, to put it simply.
Right. Well, thank you so much. I don't think we have time to go through all of the sacraments in the church, but I know that it's the study of the rites of the church, you have said, reveals the foundation of the Catholic theology. Perhaps we can just say a short word about marriage, which is, I believe, a sacrament, but perhaps thought of a little bit differently than we usually think. The minister is the person who marries the couple. But I believe, in fact, the couple marry each other with the facilitator there in the role of the priest. Could you share a little more about the kind of a theology of marriage?
Yes, that's exactly right. So that in a Roman Catholic wedding, the priest doesn't say, "I now pronounce you man and wife." Why? Because the couple, when they say to each other, you know, "I take you to be my wife, to be my husband," and then they recite the promises, they technically marry each other. And yes, the priest serves as the official witness of the church. This is how the church became involved with marriage in the first place. There was a problem in the early Middle Ages with secret marriages, where, you know, two, like Romeo and Juliet, try to run off and marry each other. But then later on, if one of them chose to leave the other, there was no way of knowing that they had been married. So the church then provides an official witness for this wedding. For Roman Catholics, marriage is a sacrament because, as all sacraments, they are signs of God's presence among us. And with marriage specifically, because of the covenant. You know, we commonly say that marriage is not a contract, but a covenant. So more than a quid pro quo or this for that, the covenant promises, in the covenant, the two promise each other to love each other fully, freely, and unconditionally, you know, and this is forever, right? So this is something similar to the way that God loves humanity. God established a covenant between himself and humanity and promised to care for us fully, freely, and forever, unconditionally, and asked for our love in return. But no matter what, God remains faithful to us. And I think in marriage we get the closest glimpse of God's love we'll ever know, when two people, albeit imperfect, claim their love for each other in this covenant. Now, a part of this, too, is, as you mentioned before, with baptism, this doesn't mean we will never sin again. With marriage, too, I think it's important because forgiveness is important.
Yeah.
I'm sure many of your listeners will remember that movie Love Story, in that famous or notorious line, you know, "Love means never having to say you're sorry." Well, right?
Yeah.
Talk to married couples and they will laugh at that. If anything, thing, marriage means always having to say you're sorry, right? And so even here, in this loving relationship, couples will hurt one another. But hopefully they learn how to ask for forgiveness. And in a sense, they administer the forgiveness of Christ just as he did when he walked the earth. So in this way, marriage gives us a sign of God's presence in our midst. We find God in all things like marriage.
Thank you very much, Father Thomas. As we come towards the end of the program, I did want to let listeners know that all of your website or contact information will be posted on our homepage shortly at GodspeedInstitute.com. I would like to share a little bit about, since we're talking about God's love and marriage and all kinds of St. Ignatius and everything today, a little bit about Claire of Assisi. Before we close the program on Care's Tip for Your Spiritual Tool Belt. So you can hang on, and if you have a thought, please feel free to share it. I wanted to share about Claire, which many people may not know about. I think Francis of Assisi is a hugely popular saint, but Claire was the first Franciscan woman, and he preached to her for about a year when he was in his 20s and she was about 18. And finally, she, as a noble woman like Ignatius and Francis, made that decision as well to step away from her world and to go live the gospel life. It was a very powerful transition for her. Basically, she stepped through the door of the dead in her house, which they had, where they would take those who have passed on in the family out through a specific door. And that was the door the young lady ran out through one evening secretly. She stepped over that threshold and out of her childhood forever. She stood on the piazza in Assisi in a darkness that must have seemed both overwhelming and expectant with the stardust of life and the starkness of death and the brightness of the mystery of all God's butterflies. She had an appointment to keep, a secret rendezvous with the midwife of her soul, and she departed through the Arezzo gate of Assisi and began to run to the Porzioncula, the tiny stone chapel of St. Mary of the Angels that Francis had rebuilt and loved so dearly. This small, intimate chapel is cherished not only because it's where Francis and his brothers lived in early community, it's also the place at which Claire was joined to Francis for life together in their love of God. For her, it was the wedding chapel of her soul. For Francis, it would become the place at which he wished to depart this life. She ran to the chapel where, waiting to receive her, Francis and the brothers were keeping watch and observing sacred vigils by candlelight. Claire found her way through the darkness to the chapel. The brothers came to welcome her, the light of candles illuminating the night and the light of love illuminating their eyes. And there at the altar was Francis. In this intimate place, surrounded by love, Claire was consecrated as the first Franciscan woman, taking her lifelong vows of love of God, poverty, and chastity. Like Francis before her, she surrendered her fine clothes and was given a sackcloth robe and a belt of cord. Then Claire knelt before God and offered to Francis with joy the very symbol of her worldly glory, her long, beautiful golden hair. Francis cut her hair himself. He gave her the tonsure, the shaven head or crown worn by monks. She surrendered a worldly beauty for what she was known for, to stand with him. Francis cut away the very thing he loved, enjoyed, and gazed upon. They did this for divine love. And after a life of living alone in her spirituality, Francis, beginning with himself, also gave Claire the most precious gift of like-minded souls, a community. The reception and investiture of Claire made her at once a spiritual daughter, spouse, and colleague to Francis, but this is where Francis took a tremendous risk for the first Franciscan woman. He simply had no authority to witness her act of profession, her vows. That role was reserved for bishops, especially in the case of a noble woman. Francis was not and never intended to be even a priest. He and his brothers could have been arrested that night for their interaction with Claire. The entire Franciscan movement halted right then and there. But to Francis, welcoming Claire's light into their life was simply the right thing to do. That would be contemplation in action, I believe. What are your thoughts there, Father Thomas?
Well, thank you for sharing that. I think it's a good example of the freedom we talked about before, you know, along with the contemplative in action. But here is a woman who was very free to follow her own journey. Would that we more of us could be as free in our own lives.
Yes, and there's some risk-taking involved there. Spirituality is not necessarily just about finding peace. Sometimes our spirituality as we mature is about entering a little bit of a discomfort zone to grow.
Right. Jesus had warned about that too. You know, that sometimes people will misunderstand you, you know, want to disown you, as they did in her case, as with Francis, too.
Yeah.
And so now I think it's what's important that one doesn't enter into this journey alone, but through a community, maybe through spiritual direction, to make sure that we are on the right path here,
yeah.
That it's really God who's calling us along the way. You know, Claire had Francis to help her along the way. We need others to walk with us.
Yes, and today I'm very thankful that you walked with us on this journey. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, Father Thomas. Please make sure to stay in touch. Any news about your books or articles, just let us know. We will post them on the website as well as we stay in our relationship. I want to thank you for being our guest today and sharing about Ignatius Loyola and the Jesuits and your good work.
Oh, you're very welcome, Carrie. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us for the Godspeed Institute today. This program was recorded live on the Progressive Radio Network in New York City and produced by Michael Hallenbeck. The Godspeed Institute is an independent educational organization dedicated to promoting religious tolerance and celebrating the value of spiritually based living. If you would like to hear this or any of our previous programs again, or send it to someone, simply go to GodspeedInstitute.com. Please send your comments to office@GodspeedInstitute.com. We always enjoy hearing from you. And join us again as we continue to explore all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems right here at PRN.FM every Sunday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Until then, we wish you Godspeed on your journey.